It's not all-out war, but the Israeli-occupied West Bank is boiling over. Israeli troops just carried out their biggest military operation there in years.
They're showing that they don't see the Palestinian Authority as an important partner for Israel's security, and that's a very important shift.
I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, in pursuit of economic growth, European governments are facing a choice.
If you want to grow your GDP, I mean, you can have babies, you can have immigrants, or you can have machines. That's it.
But Europe is trying to close the door on undocumented migrants.
And raising butterflies in rural Kenya to keep local ecosystems healthy.
And also their key pollinators. They play a very crucial role in our environment in terms of food security.
Food security at home, then they sell the butterflies abroad.
All those stories today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. In the Israeli-occupied West Bank today, a 26-year-old American woman was killed. Local news reports say she was shot by Israeli troops. Ayşenur Ezgiaygi, who's also a Turkish citizen, was at a protest in a Palestinian town near the city of Nablus. The Israeli military says the incident happened during a violent demonstration. The White House says it is deeply disturbed by the killing. The Turkish government calls her death murder.
Today's news follows a nearly week-long operation by Israeli troops in the northern part of the West Bank. Hundreds of soldiers were involved. The World's Shirin Jafari has more.
Men carried the body of 16-year-old Lujain Musleh as they chanted, "There's only one God." His father says Musleh was killed by an Israeli sniper while she was looking out of the window of her home in Jenin City in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military says it's reviewing the incident. Today, the Israeli forces seem to withdraw from Jenin, leaving behind a scene of destruction. Palestinian authorities say water and electricity services were cut off during the operation, and families were trapped inside their homes. Footage shared online by local reporters earlier this week showed Israeli armored bulldozers ripping up the roads in the Jenin refugee camp. Palestinian authorities say 70% of the streets have been destroyed. Hazem Masareh, who works with the ambulance services in the West Bank, told the Associated Press that the road destructions have made his job impossible. Medical teams can't reach those who need our help, he said. Aid can't get through. Violence in the occupied West Bank has been growing since Hamas's attack on October 7th. This latest Israeli operation targeted three main areas in the north and east. Daniel Byman is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Israel is feeling an increased threat from different militant cells in the West Bank, which has risen since October 7th. And much of this, of course, is due to the tremendous sympathy Palestinians on the West Bank have for Palestinians in Gaza.
Hamas has been encouraging its supporters in the West Bank to carry out attacks, which he says adds to the already complicated situation there.
We see settler attacks, often unprovoked, on Palestinians in the West Bank, and these attacks are at times enabled by the Israeli government and the Israeli military, and that produces a response. So there are a lot of different dynamics going into this.
In the past, Israel would have relied on the Palestinian Authority to keep things under control in the occupied West Bank, Byman adds. But now, by using its own forces, it's sending a message.
They're showing that they don't see the Palestinian Authority as an important partner for Israel's security. And that's a very important shift in a political sense.
That goes against the idea that the Palestinian Authority can and should play a role in the future governance of the Palestinians, he says. Rafael Cohen with the RAND Corporation says over the past few weeks, there's been a rise in calls for suicide attacks inside of Israel.
Those suicide attacks and car bombings are more likely to come from the West Bank than from Gaza or elsewhere. Both in terms of what Hamas infrastructure has left, it's also easier to get from the West Bank into central Israel than it is from Gaza.
Even before October 7th, Cohen says, Palestinians in the West Bank were under increasing pressure. Settlements have been growing, increasing frictions between settlers and Palestinians. Adding to that are the restrictions that the Israeli government imposed on movement and work visas of Palestinians after the October attack. Yehuda Fuchs, the commander responsible for the West Bank, warned about increasing resentments, he says.
So in some ways, that warning is coming to fulfillment here, and you're beginning to see this boil over into outright violence.
While the Israeli military has stated its immediate objectives in the West Bank, its long-term plan is not clear, Cohen explains.
In fact, if there's a critique of Israeli strategy, it all tends to be very, very tactical without that sort of broader strategic vision of, like, how do you get to a more sustainable place over the long haul?
This morning, as Israeli forces withdrew from Jenin, the city's mayor, Nidal Abu Saleh, estimated that the cost of the destruction could be more than $13 million. That's on top of the $26 million in damages that other Israeli incursions in the West Bank have caused in the past 11 months, he said. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The big winners from the Olympic tennis competitions are not the ones dominating the court at the U.S. Open right now. A different crop of athletes is taking over this week. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on who's left in the final Grand Slam of the year.
Jessica Pegula has been a professional tennis player for 11 years, but she wasn't playing her best at the start of last night's semifinal match against Karolina Muhova.
15-30, 1-2, way wide, and Pegula, she looks stiff and out of sorts in that first serve.
Pegula herself admitted as much in a post-match interview.
She made me look like a beginner. I was, like, about to, like, burst into tears because it was embarrassing. Like, she was destroying me.
It only takes a few points for momentum to switch, though, and luckily for Pegula, that happened just in time.
Forehand from Muhova is wide, and Jessica Pegula raises her arms and says yes, because she is in to the U.S. Open final.
In a career milestone, Pegula earned her ticket to her first ever Grand Slam final, calling the achievement a childhood dream come true.
I'm just happy to be in the final, but obviously I come here to want to win the title, let alone being able to do that, you know, in my home country here at my, you know, home slam.
Tomorrow, she'll face Arina Sabalenka of Belarus.
In behind it, volley Sabalenka, Navarro lob, Sabalenka with an overhead, good! And Arina Sabalenka soars!
Sabalenka is making her second U.S. Open final in as many years after losing last year to Coco Gauff. In that match, the crowd cheered almost exclusively for Gauff, a popular American sports star. It got to Sabalenka's head. She says she's expecting the same crowd behavior tomorrow, but this time she's ready for it.
Last year was very tough experience, very tough lesson, and it's not going to happen again. You have to control your emotions. You have to focus on yourself and fight for it.
The semifinal action continues today on the men's side of the tournament. First up is Englishman Jack Draper versus Italian Jannik Sinner.
Injection of pace on one of those forehands that was unbelievable from Sinner.
Sinner is the top-ranked player in the world right now, and he's recently been at the top of the headlines, too.
Jannik Sinner tested positive twice for a banned anabolic steroid in March.
The banned steroid is called Clostobal, and it reportedly got into Sinner's system during a massage.
His physio was using a topical cream for a wound that he had. He then gave full-body massages, not using gloves, as a part of his normal routine with Jannik Sinner.
The news That's only became public a couple of weeks ago. A sports tribunal has found that Sinner isn't to blame for the positive tests. Still, he was stripped of some ranking points and had to return some prize money. Many in the tennis world are pointing out his punishment was significantly less than what other athletes have been subject to. Even retired pro Roger Federer weighed in this week on NBC's Today.
I think we all trust pretty much that Jannik didn't do anything, but the inconsistency potentially that he didn't have to sit out while they were not 100% sure what was going on, I think that's the question here.
The World Anti-Doping Agency and Italy's Anti-Doping Agency could still appeal the decision in Sinner's case. Tonight in New York, a massive crowd will fill the stadium to watch American Taylor Fritz versus American Francis Tiafoe. And few tennis players can galvanize fans quite like Tiafoe.
Always a popular player, no matter what tournament he plays at.
Tiafoe's parents immigrated to the U.S. from the West African country, Sierra Leone. His dad got a job building tennis courts, and Tiafoe was allowed to use those courts for free. Now 26 years old, Tiafoe's success has inspired people in his parents' home country. He's only beaten his opponent, Taylor Fritz, once before, though, and making it to Sunday's final is going to be anything but easy. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The populations of many types of butterflies are in decline. Climate change, the loss of natural habitats, and the use of pesticides all play a part. But one recent study found that human intervention can make a difference. This includes stuff like planting wildflowers that attract butterflies. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, visited Kilifi County on Kenya's eastern coast, where she met people in rural communities who are raising butterflies for export.
In a small room at the Kipipeo Butterfly Project in the village of Gede, local farmers are coming in and out carrying small plastic containers. Inside are different species of butterfly pupae they've been breeding. One at a time, they lift the worm-like shells off their cotton beds and onto the table. Some are hard and still. Others are soft and wiggling.
15, 16, 17, 18.
Staff efficiently count the different species of butterflies before dumping them into a collection box.
This is called flying handkerchief. This is the most expensive butterfly, selling at $2. Very beautiful, big, colorful.
Over the course of the year, they can collectively earn about $200,000 off these pupae. That's if research scientist and project manager Hussein Abdullahi Aden is able to sell and ship the pupae to buyers in Europe before they turn into butterflies and burst out of their cocoons.
We are working within, you know, around 48 hours for this consignment to reach the destination. So it is, you know, rushing against time.
This butterfly project started back in the 90s as an attempt to address growing deforestation and other threats to the nearby Arubogo Sokoke forest, which is rich in biodiversity.
During that time, there was a high rate of human wildlife conflict. In essence, that we have wildlife like elephants, buffaloes, and then also the baboons, which normally invade rural communities' farmlands.
Locals wanted the wildlife out and to be able to settle in the forest themselves and use its resources. Conservationists and local officials came up with a different plan and convinced farmers that they could earn a living from the forest by breeding and selling butterflies. Over the years, they've exported butterflies all over the world, although these days, most of the butterflies are bound for Europe.
Different exhibition zoos, museums, live exhibits, others are private collectors. But majority of almost 80% of our products normally ends up at private zoos and botanical gardens.
Hundreds of breeders have participated in this project over the years. Msamzu Krisa is one of them. He says he was so surprised when he learned that butterflies could earn him money. Krisa sometimes goes into the forest to collect specific species of butterflies and then brings them home to breed. He says this business is really helping to protect the forest, because otherwise people would be cutting down the trees and killing the wildlife. But the butterfly industry can be volatile. This year isn't as good as previous ones, he says, because the temperature has been hotter. Climate, export bureaucracy, and fluctuating seasonal demand all impact the supply and demand for the butterflies. And farmers only get paid for the pupae that arrive in good condition. The pupae that don't sell are put into a nearby exhibition house in Watamu for tourists. Inside the sanctuary, black, white, and yellow-colored butterflies have hatched from their cocoons. They flutter around a water fountain and hop from one flower to the next.
The presence of these insects clearly demonstrates the health of a certain ecosystem. And also they are key pollinators. They play a very crucial role in our environment in terms of food security.
In other words, butterflies are more than just a pretty face. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Kilifi, Kenya.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This next story is about rape, and so I will give this warning. It includes some details that are extremely disturbing. This week in the south of France, a 71-year-old woman named Gisèle Pelicot took the stand in a case that has shocked the country. Her ex-husband, along with 50 other men, are accused of raping her repeatedly over a decade. The details are craven. Her former husband allegedly drugged her and would invite other men over to rape her, often while videotaping the encounters. This case has triggered a larger conversation about rape in France. Anne-Cécile Mayfair is president of Fondation des Femmes, or the Women's Foundation. It funds groups that promote women's rights and works to end violence against women. I asked Mayfair why the plaintiff, Gisèle, opted for a public trial, even though French law would allow the case to be tried in private.
She wants her case to be heard because, first of all, she says that she doesn't have to be ashamed because she did nothing wrong. And the second reason why she wanted the trial to be public is also because she wants rape under drug abuse to be known and to be recognized as a serious issue in France. And she wants to help other women.
It's just an astonishing and horrific case. I want to focus now on the larger issues that this case brings up. In France, rape is defined as intercourse committed by, quote, violence, coercion, threat, or surprise. Does this case challenge that definition at all because the victim was unconscious when these acts occurred?
Yeah, it doesn't challenge the rape definition in France because the surprise category is actually made for that. Apparently, what you can see in the video is that she's totally unconscious, that she's snoring, sleeping, or really not conscious. So she didn't know. By surprise means she didn't have the time or the consciousness to even say, she couldn't say yes or no because she was drugged and she was sleeping. So the rape definition in France does work in that aspect.
The European Union has proposed a law that would define rape as sex without consent. And so far, France has not supported that proposal. Why not?
There is a debate in France about whether we should change the law or not. What the law is saying in France is that rape is when somebody has a sexual intercourse using force, strength, using surprise, using any means that make the victim unavailable to consent in any way. So it's underlined by the definition, and the definition is centered on the suspect, on the culprit, on the perpetrator. What did he do? How did he use the difference of power? How did he use the fact that he's stronger, the fact that he's conscious and she's not? Because rape is an abuse of power. So our definition in France is not bad, actually. The problem is our judicial system, our judges, and a lot of people in France don't understand it, don't use it in the proper way. And this is why that there is this debate in France, but it's a real debate. And you can see that in France, we do think about consent, but we prefer in the definition to be centered on how did the perpetrator behave? Like, what did he do instead of focusing on the victim? Because if you focus too much on the victim, then you start to behave a little bit like in the rape culture, like, what did she do? How did she dress? What did she say? You have to look at the perpetrator. You have to look at him.
And I'll just point out that often sexual assault is between a man and a woman, but it can happen between any combination of people.
Yes.
So you're saying that France's definition places the culpability on the perpetrator. How is the EU definition, the proposed EU definition, different? Are you arguing that relying on consent puts too much of the onus on a potential victim?
For some countries, it is probably a good evolution because a lot of countries in the EU, their definition was only a rape is sex using force. So for all these countries, a definition based on consent is a positive evolution. But the law in France is better than consent. It encompasses all the different ways that you can be raped, and it's focusing on the behavior of the perpetrator. I know that this debate is a bit complicated and difficult, and I know that consent is kind of a fashionable word and everybody wants to use it and why it is not in our law. But actually, the way that our law is written, in my perspective and in the perspective of a lot of feminist organizations in France, is actually a good law. And it was written by feminist organizations 20 years ago. Mm. And they thought about all of that and they decided not to write consent, because 20 years ago they said whether a victim gave her consent or not is not relevant. The only thing we have to look at is what did the perpetrator do? How did he abuse the power he had over the victim? And this is like the only thing we have to look at, because there are so many victims who will at a point say, okay, but does it mean that they really consent? Like, if you say okay and if you say yes, but you are younger, you're poor and he's rich, you're scared in any ways, then is consent a real consent? So this is why we'd preferred not to use consent in our definition in France.
How is this case that is so in the news right now, the case of Giselle and the crimes allegedly committed by her ex-husband and 50 other men, how is it shaping discourse about rape in France right now?
It is shaping discourse about the fact that a husband can rape, because this is very taboo. In our society, we can accept the fact that some very monstrous, bizarre men walking at night and in the parking garage, that they can rape women, right? But that your own husband during 10 years could have raped, this is something that is very traumatic, because it's a reality that people don't want to see. Because in France, the first time that a marital rape was convicted was in 1994. Before that, it didn't exist, rape in a couple, rape in a relationship. And the second thing is that there were so many of them, so many men who participated and so many men who didn't say anything. They raped that woman. They knew that her husband was raping her and they didn't say anything. The husband said that 3 out of 10 men that he would propose, he would offer his wife to, 3 of them would say yes. That's huge. But what happened to the 7 others? Like, why didn't they say anything to the police? And this is also very traumatic right now in France, because you realize that there are so many men complicit. And this is something that shifts the discourse, you know, like, okay, a few of them are rapists. But come on, not your husband. And there are so many good men that, of course, if they would see something like this happening, they would report it. It is really questioning the masculinity, the way that so many men can tolerate violence against women and would say nothing and wouldn't help her. It's a crime. Rape is a crime. And they let a crime be committed. This is, I think, what's the most discussed right now also in France about this case. And thanks to Giselle, I really hope that, because this trial is public, I really hope it will open a conversation between men, and that men will also have this conversation about their masculinity, about how important it is to side by women, to be with us when a crime is committed against a woman, to be with us when there is inequality between men and women, to be on our side.
Anne-Cécile Mayfair is president of the Women's Foundation in France. She spoke to us from Paris. You're listening to The World.
Professional soccer, basketball, and hockey have been global for years. American football is playing catch-up with more and more global players.
So you have America Samoa, Australia, Nigeria, Canada. These are some of the most popular locations where there are currently internationally born players.
That's ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Europe needs immigrants, millions of them over the next few decades, according to some studies. Birth rates are falling and workforces are shrinking. But at the same time, there's a backlash across the continent against migration. That's in part because record numbers of people fleeing hardship and conflict in all kinds of places are crossing into European countries looking to stay. The World's Jerry Hadden reports from Spain, where squaring these divergent realities is proving to be difficult.
Spain depends on foreign workers and needs more. To understand how much so, looking back on the COVID crisis helps.
No,
This is peach farmer Josep Maria Compañes, trying to reach one of his contracted workers by phone in Mauritania. No answer, he told me, frustrated. I visited him in Catalonia in 2020, just before the harvest. The pandemic was in full swing. We've been working with these guys for 10 years, he said. They know how to do this job, how everything works. They are really important. But they couldn't come. Some 60,000 legal, seasonal farm workers from Africa missed the Spanish harvest that year, hitting farmers like Compañes hard. The worker shortfall was short-lived, but call it a trial run because there's a larger one looming. The Bank of Spain says by 2050, Spain will need some 24 million additional workers to fuel the economy and to pay the pensions of retirees who are living longer than ever. 24 million is roughly half of Spain's entire population today. That's a lot of people. And the current political crisis around migrants isn't making it easier for people to come or for politicians to promote more immigration. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez was just in Senegal, Mauritania, and the Gambia. It was an emergency visit to stop, well, an emergency, the record number of people coming to the Canary Islands illegally by boat from West Africa. From January to July this year, nearly 20,000 people, according to Spain's Interior Ministry.
Apoyando la lucha contra las mafias, el crimen organizado.
Sanchez announced aid to the West African nations to crack down on human smugglers and money for worker training programs in Africa to create an orderly system of immigration. He was vague on details, but his message was meant to calm Spaniards increasingly worried about the new arrivals. On a recent evening, some 200 migrants from Nigeria, Mali, and elsewhere arrived by bus to a hotel in a Spanish tourist town called Tossa de Mar. They're part of a government program to resettle new arrivals across the country. None I reach out to want to talk, but tourists in the same hotel complex just across the street come out to watch, curious. Among them are Owen Burns and Alan Murray, two young Brits. They say they have mixed feelings about the migrants.
I think it's good the help's been offered, but like peak tourist light season is a bit like, I guess it's not a good timing, but how do you time something like that?
This is a sister hotel, right? So there are some facilities that I don't know if we're allowed to go in there and like use. So it's affected us.
Tossa de Mar's mayor has complained to the central government, saying scenes like this will drive tourists away. In another Spanish village, Mora de Robielos, population 1,400, 120 Malian migrants were just dropped off at a hotel. Locals say they had no idea they were coming or how to handle the influx. Local far-right politician Alejandro Nolasco told reporters that residents there have no idea who these migrants are, why they've come, what languages they speak, or whether they have criminal records. Across Europe, the rise of the far right has mainstream politicians alarmed. They say extremists have unfairly fomented xenophobia to win over voters, most recently in France and state elections in Germany. To be fair, the number of people entering Europe illegally is tiny compared to those who come with visas, but the political problem remains. How to square the need for more outside workers with the potential backlash at the polls? Javier Diaz is a specialist in pensions and immigration at the IESE Business School in Madrid.
If you want to grow your GDP, I mean, you can have babies, you can have immigrants, or you can have machines. That's it.
But it's too late for babies, he says. Even if enough were born tomorrow to make up for the labor shortfall, they wouldn't enter the workforce for another 20 years. As for immigrants, he says, in the case of Spain, 24 million is untenable.
It has to be the robots. It has to be the algorithms.
In other words, wealth generated by technology, more automation, etc.
And by the way, machines and algorithms, don't collect pensions. They are non-pensionable.
But no one knows yet to what degree technology will impact human jobs. People are still needed. Gemma Pinyol, an immigration expert at Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona, says Spain and the rest of Europe do have options to attract more workers.
Si nos gusta más el sistema de puntos que tiene Canadá.
You need to look at what schemes we like best, she says. The Canadian model based on points for qualified workers, hiring directly in the countries of origin and bringing workers over, or expanding temporary visa programs. The problem, she says, is really building consensus, as there was for taking in Ukrainian refugees at the start of Russia's full-scale invasion, and that perennial bugaboo, red tape. Spain, like many EU countries, requires workers to secure a job before they arrive. That process can take months or longer. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Barcelona.
For a long time, American football was uniquely, well, American. But the NFL is trying to change that. The league has held regular season games in London and Mexico City. And this weekend, as the NFL season gets into full swing, there's a game in Sao Paulo, Brazil, for the very first time. The NFL isn't the only professional sports league from the U.S. trying to expand globally. Lisa Delpy-Nerati is a professor of sports management and marketing at George Washington University. Lisa, why is the NFL looking at Brazil to grow overseas interest in the game?
Well, NFL understands the importance of adding new fans, and Brazil is a large country with a sports culture. They have a lot of people who enjoy watching sports, and I think they see it as a great opportunity.
The NFL is also planning for a game in Madrid for the very first time this season. How well is American pro football catching on in Europe?
NFL has been in Europe since 2007. I actually had a chance to attend that first game, and it's been growing and growing ever since. Many other leagues have been expanding their footprint for years, and the NFL is really catching up and is moving full force ahead. And so moving into, you know, Spain or Germany, they've been in England, going down to Brazil, it's just part of their marketing strategy. New fans result in increased broadcast fees, increased merchandise, basically more revenue to the league. So now that flag football will be in the LA 28 games, this is an opportunity to introduce football at a grassroots level, because research has shown that people who play the sport are more likely to watch the sport.
We're talking about the NFL, but the NBA and NHL are looking to attract fans overseas as well. But those sports are already more international than American football. Where are those leagues at in terms of going global?
Well, the NBA has more Chinese social media followers than they have American followers. So they are already very diverse in their international reach. They've been doing basketball beyond borders for years, where they've been holding camps in different countries and really expanding the footprint of basketball. NFL is just now starting to do international player pathways and NFL Academy for international players. You know, the other sports have really been more advanced. The NHL hockey is very popular in Europe, especially Scandinavia. So they already had a major leap ahead of other leagues.
Now, another thing about the NBA and the NHL is that they already have a number of foreign-born players. Does that give them a big advantage in terms of expanding the fan base overseas?
You know, right now, Nigeria has one of the largest population of NFL internationally born players. So you have America Samoa, Australia, Nigeria, Canada. These are some of the most popular locations where there are currently internationally born players.
Is that true for the NBA as well? I mean, over the years, they've had players from as far and wide as China, you know, many countries in Africa.
Right. Right now, I mean, the last NBA draft, you saw four French players come in. So they have really heavily expanded. You have Ghanaians, and they've started the Basketball African League, BAL. And that's all about, you know, providing opportunities for the African players to play professionally in the hopes of many of them coming into the NBA.
How likely are we to see a Super Bowl or an NBA playoff game happen overseas anytime soon?
Well, the NFL just stated that they would like to see a regularly scheduled game each week internationally. And with that, one of the playoffs could happen there. I think it'll be a while to have a Super Bowl, because that's very popular in the United States. But I would say, you know, within 20 years, I wouldn't doubt it. And it would be in a location like London, where it's easy for Americans to travel to.
Is a lot of the interest in these other countries just kind of, it's something new, I'm going to go watch it. I may not know what's going on, but it's kind of cool. I mean, is there a curiosity factor in who goes to the games?
The NFL goes in early and starts hyping it up.
But there is just a curiosity factor coupled by Americana, right? A lot of people internationally want to touch anything that's American. You know, people are really excited at the beginning of the games. And as the games go on and they don't really know the strategy behind it, some of that excitement wears off. But I think the more and more they learn about the sports and understand the rules, the more excitement will sustain throughout the games.
Lisa Delpy Nerotti is a professor of sports management and marketing at George Washington University.
Staying on sports of a slightly less flashy variety, the Scottish island of Easdale is hosting the annual World Stone Skimming Championship tomorrow. The island is home to only 62 people, but is expecting some 350 skimmers from 20 countries for the competition.
Each competitor is allowed 3 tries. The stones that you skim or skip must come from Easdale, which is a great place to find them. It was home to a slate mining industry until a storm flooded the quarry last century, and that quarry is where the competition will take place.
Stone skimming, as opposed to skipping, means the focus is not on how many bounces your stone takes off the water, but how far it travels. Last year, the winning stone traveled 170 meters. That's 558 feet.
The winning skimmer gets a trophy, and there's a huge party after the event for participants, spectators, and residents alike. If you're up for the challenge, the skimming starts at 11 a.m. The first ferry from the mainland leaves at 7:45.
The folks in Balneário Camboriú want to attract more tourists. The Brazilian beachfront town is trying to emulate Orlando by building family-friendly theme parks. But as Michael Fox reports, there is some trouble in paradise.
A group of schoolchildren wait outside the aquarium in Balneário Camboriú. Above them, the tentacles of a giant orange model of an octopus hang over the top of the building. It's one of the largest aquariums in southern Brazil. It's really incredible, says Augusto Barbosa, whose family traveled from the northeastern state of Espírito Santo halfway across the country to come here. The girls have loved what they've seen. See, the aquarium is just one of countless attractions across the city. There's a pirate adventure, an old car show, a dinosaur park, immersive 3D virtual reality rides, a gondola trip up the mountain, a huge Ferris wheel, and it's all packed amid sky-high buildings into a 5-mile-long sandy half-moon stretch of coastline that is lit up at night.
It almost reminds you of something like out of one of the first series of Star Wars or some futuristic movie, you know, where like there's this crazy futuristic world.
Real estate agent Maria Elisa Veronese Bayur says that's the idea, a new world city. And it's driven up demand. Balneário Camboriú today has the highest square market real estate price in Brazil. And it's become a bit of a playground for the rich in Brazil, with families buying vacation apartments at the shore in Balneário Camboriú. It's a paradise here. We have a very warm winter and a summer with a lot of people, she says. We don't have problems with crime. It's relatively safe. It's marvelous. That is what makes the price the highest in Brazil. Tourism is key. Balneário Camboriú is one of the top 10 family destinations in the country, according to a 2023 report. Roughly 2 million tourists visit the city each year. We've been here 3 times, says Diego Fischer, who traveled with his family from Rio de Janeiro State. But there are new things that weren't here the last time, like the planetarium and the aquarium. Fischer says the growth of the city's theme parks remind him of Orlando, Florida, which he visited when he went to Disney World. It's very similar, with all the other different attractions and things to do, he says. And in fact, Balneário Camboriú is also home to the nearby Beto Carreiro World, the largest theme park in Latin America. That was built in 1991. But the theme park development has really exploded in recent years.
Yes, actually, in these 5 years, we opened 10 attractions. So we are open 2 per year.
Kiko Berger is the head of the Grupo Oceanic, the company behind most of the city's new attractions.
Our population really looks for new innovation attractions. So we visit everything we can outside and try to bring the best quality as possible with affordable price.
The latest space adventure is a NASA-themed experience where you travel from mission control to the moon. It boasts of having the largest collection of NASA items outside the United States. All of this has helped to spur tourism and development. The population of Balneario Camboriú has grown roughly 30% over the last decade. Per capita GDP has doubled over the same period, and it's been a success. But there's a dark side to the city's explosive growth. Thaisa da Silva Alves is a delivery woman and Uber driver. She was born and raised here, but she says that's becoming a rare quality.
Andar na rua, vai ver mais gente de fora, do Rio Grande do Sul, do Paraná.
If you walk on the street today, you see people from neighboring states or any place else, but it's hard to find people who were born and raised here, she says. That is because rising rental prices have far outpaced salaries, she says, even in working-class neighborhoods far from the glitzy high-rise buildings. She pays rent and has to share a home with several family members. Da Silva drives up a hillside behind the city. Modest homes and cinder block buildings lay before the backdrop of skyscrapers. She explains that for her, the city is beautiful, but it also seems like an illusion with its hotels and amusement parks. Tourists come here, she says, and they see a shine that I don't see. I live here, I work here. Tourists see a clean, organized city, not me. I see a road with potholes. Da Silva says she loves her city, and there are more opportunities for work than in many other places, but it comes at a high cost, long hours, not sufficient enough reward. And there is no end in sight for how high Balneario Camboriú will continue to rise. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Balneario Camboriú, Brazil.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The Dachstein Glacier in Austria is nearly 9,000 feet high, but scientists say that it's likely to melt completely by the end of the century. An artist from Cleveland, Ohio, was commissioned to create a work of art that would give the glacier a voice with a warning about the impact of climate change. Reporter Jamie Fullerton joined a tour of an ice cave beneath the glacier as the artist launched his project.
Dachstein-Kappenstein. At the first stop, middle station Schönbergalm, you will find the Dachstein Giant Ice Cave and the Mammoth Cave.
A cable car takes me halfway up a mountain to a nature park flanked by huge pine trees and sheer rock faces. I'm beneath Dachstein Glacier in Salzkammergut, a rural alpine region of Austria. The region was selected to be a European Capital of Culture for 2024. Artists from around the world are showing works in hundreds of locations around here.
Hi, Bill. Finally, we're talking about art.
In the shadows of the vast trees, American sound artist Bill Fontana is introduced to a group of tourists, journalists, and local politicians.
I wanted to do projects that explored this dimension of reality, that music was going on all the time around us somehow, that the world was full of kind of amazing, secret, hidden patterns of sound.
Fontana was invited to create a sound sculpture using the Dachstein Glacier as an artistic comment on climate change. He travelled up the glacier around 2,000 metres above sea level and placed underwater microphones around the melting ice. He's playing the resulting water sounds through speakers in a huge ice cave in the mountain beneath the glacier. The ice cave is popular with tourists. Metal walkways are placed around massive, bulbous blocks of ice, formed from water running down from the glacier. As part of the sound sculpture, Fontana mixes his melting glacier sounds with ambient vibration recordings he made in 2022 from the dormant bells of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. In 2019, Notre Dame suffered huge fire damage, but its bells survived. Dachstein Glacier is also suffering damage, like many glaciers globally.
The issue of melting glaciers is very emblematic of the whole crisis of climate change in the world.
I grabbed a word with Fontana.
And to hear the voice, real voice, of this famous melting glacier that's hundreds, thousands of years old. And one way, it's a very interesting and beautiful sound, but to me it's also a very sad sound, because it's the sound of something dying.
Earlier, I spoke to meteorologist Wolfgang Traunmüller. He's been surveying Dachstein Glacier since 2006 with his weather forecasting company, Blue Sky Wetter Analysen. Traunmüller's team runs simulations to predict when the glacier will disappear completely.
And there you can see that the glacier will nearly disappear at the end of the century. Only some small fields of snow or ice in the regions of the summit of the glacier will then still remain.
Traunmüller said that since 2006, the thickness of one of the Dachstein glacier sections has shrunk by 22 metres.
We have a natural climate change with the big ice ages, all 100,000 years and so on, that's normal. But this effect now is very fast, this warming. The humankind should think about, okay, we are responsible and we could influence the future.
In the Dachstein ice cave, tourists wrapped in winter coats stand next to the ice blocks. Their eyes are closed as they listen to Bill Fontana's duet between the melting glacier and Notre Dame's bells. Sylvia Frank travelled here from Germany.
You know that the mountains are in danger and that the gletscher will go and everything, you know this. But when you are here and you can hear the noise of the water, it's something else, it's something different. It touches me in my inside.
Can art like this really change things? Fontana hopes that the right people will be listening.
Doing something like this is a way of having some impact on the public and also maybe on the leaders of governments and to just create an emotional motivation to do something.
For The World, I'm Jamie Fullerton in Dachstein Giant Ice Cave.
When the musician Keturah left her remote village in Malawi, she was just 14 years old. She was a teenager with a big dream of recording music. It's an origin story not unlike another musical prodigy who you've probably heard of, Taylor Swift.
But this is Keturah's story. The young teen relocated to Blantyre, the second largest city in Malawi, and booked a recording studio. And then she landed a record deal. And soon she earned the nickname Naliyela, or local girl. But things quickly went south when her producer took off with her tapes. More shades of Taylor Swift.
In 2022, with the help of a local cultural center for Malawian orphans, Keturah moved again, this time to California, where she worked with members of the global music collective Playing for Change.
Keturah's debut album soon followed. John Densmore of The Doors got involved, playing percussion on it.
Earlier this year, Keturah dropped another tune, a single titled Make Dele. She went back to Malawi to film the music video. Now 28, Keturah continues to add to her repertoire of guitar-based East African pop. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other out there and join us right back here on Monday.